This is March, April 14th, 2011. We are at the home of Frances Gallagher Keith in Great Falls, Montana. And this is just going to be a little story of telling me about yourself. So why don't you start with your name, Fran, or your full name.
The whole name?
Sure.
Frances Veronica Gallagher Keith.
All right. And where and when were you born?
I was born 1929 in a farmhouse south of Charlotte, Montana. It's western Montana.
And did you grow up there at that home?
Yes, I did. Well, we moved once to a place that a farm Dad finally was able to purchase, but it was only a mile and a half away.
And what jobs have you had during your life?
Oh my goodness. I worked for the Montana Farmers Union State Office for about 4 years. I went to college here spasmodically, and I...
Here in Great Falls?
Great Falls, at the College of Great Falls.
Okay.
While I was working, I'd take half a day work and half a day at school. And then I had 1 year of college, and I got a provisional contract to go out to a country school 12 miles south of Chinook in a rural school called New Hope School. And I had 3 students in 3 different grades. That was an interesting year. I lived in one end of the schoolhouse called a teacherage.
What year was that, Fran?
That was 1949 and 50.
Okay.
I got snowed in, snowed out. I had a sister that lived on the west of Chinook, and so each weekend the old man that taught about 6 miles south of me, he'd pick me up and we'd go into town. His family lived there. But we were, we tried to get out there one time in January, and that we were bucking snow up to the grill on his pickup. So we had one place to turn around, we did, and got back to town. And the road supervisor said, don't go out again. He said, we've got snow plows stuck out there 20 miles. So we waited a couple days and he called. Instead of going out in the evening, we thought, well, we might as well wait till morning. So we started out, he hit the same thing. The snow had bellied in and it was up to the grill again. But it was very hard. So I said, well, I know there's a telephone in one of these farmhouses. There was only 3 out there that had phones at the time. So I said, let's walk across to this farm and have him call into town. And he decided, no, he wouldn't go. So I walked across, and I could walk across the fence line. It was so hard. Got down, I thought, well, I'll take a shortcut. I got down in the coulee. I thought, I'll cut through the coulee. I went down through the coulee and I got high-centered. Snow was deeper than my legs. So I crawled out of that and got up to the man's house, the farmer's house, and they had already called town. And the poor man, I called him old then, he was probably in his 60s, but he started walking down the road in that terrible snow, and one of the neighbors finally got the call and picked him up and said he was just about finished. So then we were snowed in for 2 weeks and finally got out, but the most welcome sight in the world is a snowplow.
Oh, wonderful.
But that was one of my jobs. And then I came back to college that next year and finished my 2-year certificate, went up to Guilford and taught a year there. From there I went to Cutbank and taught. And then that summer I got married.
Okay,
in the meantime, I had worked for, off and on when I had summers off, I went back to work for the Farmers Union State Office and did recreation work, camps, teaching and so on. So besides the babysitting I did at home and for neighbors, that's kind of what I did.
Okay, so let's go back to your marriage. What age were you when you got married?
Let's see, 24.
Right.
I was 24.
And what year was that, Fran?
1953.
Okay. And tell us about your spouse, and he also of Irish ancestry?
His name is Scottish. The Keith name is Scottish. They've been here since the 1700s, so they're pretty Americanized. Okay. His mother was McCrary, and she was apparently either Irish or Scotch-Irish. Actually, that year I was out in the country school, I met him. He worked in town, and we had a bunch of young people that in town that ran around together. And he happened to be one of the dancers. Interestingly enough, it was the same school I taught at that he had gone through 8 grades. Not the same time I was there.
Right.
And so then he worked in a menswear and dry cleaning, and later moved to Fort Benton to work with a friend there. Joined the Air National Guard. On a Monday evening he was sworn in, and on Wednesday morning they were activated. So he was gone for about a year and a half. And so a year after he got back, he worked then up at Gore Hill in the civil service.
Was that during the Korean conflict?
Korean conflict, yeah.
Okay.
So during the, when he came back, they had hired him up there before they discharged him. And so he was civil service up there for about 32 years.
Okay, tell us about your children.
Oh, man. Oh, you want the names to start with?
Well, absolutely, please.
Okay, Kathleen, Vicky Jean, Julie Ann, Sharon Renee, Janice Lorene, Daniel Patrick, and Patricia Lynn.
Okay.
And they've all were good students. They all went to college. Two didn't quite finish. Kathy is, her first love is social work, and she's head of a social service agency for the counties in southwestern Wyoming. And Vicky works here for the clinic, office work, and Julie is in Boise, Idaho. She doesn't work like normally. She is a lobbyist for anti-abortion and some of those issues. Sharon lives in Valencia, California, and she is a public relations person, works for a radio station, does their ads, does their interviews, and so on. Let's see, and Janice is here, and she's a registered nurse. She works at the orthopedic area mostly now, but she works for the clinic. She spends one day there and then any other off days at the benefits. And Danny is in Missoula, and he manages a home health company. He's got his bachelor's in nursing and his master's in business, and so that's what he does. And he has a wife and 2 children. Patty is in Seattle, and she had an interpersonal communication and business degree also, and she worked for AT&T for years in Denver and in New Jersey, and then transferred to Lucent when AT&T had to divest. Worked in Seattle, and then she married and has 2 little ones, and she doesn't work now, but she was director of international global sales when she quit. So that's my kids.
Very good. So now we're going to peel back the pages and go back to some of that ancient history.
Oh boy.
Like when you were a child. So tell us when your family ancestors left Ireland. What do you know about that, Fran?
Okay, I know my dad left when he was 21, 1915. He had some brothers already in New York, and aunts and uncles here that I assume came over in the 1850s, probably during the famine, I don't know. But he and his brother and 2 other of their town people came. They were all 4 young men. And they had fought in the Irish resistance. Each county apparently had their own little militia, kind of like an underground militia, to get the English out of their county. And so he was doing that. Now, he wouldn't tell us too much about it because I think he was, the English still had control over them, and he wasn't given amnesty till 1947.
What county?
Donegal County, right. Northwestern. Mm-hmm. And so it borders the English-controlled part.
Yes.
They're very cautious about saying too much, even in Ireland right now. Let's see what else. Well, when he came over, he had a little more persuasion than just to get to freedom. They had a commander, I guess you'd say. Actually, well, I'll backtrack. He said they were trained in the basement of their church in their fighting. When they had a leader for the county, and now I remember his name was Redmond, and he sold his list of men to the English for some favor that he wanted. And so before Dad came over, they got word they had their caskets built for them, those four men. So his dad said, well, we're not going to have any more martyrs in this family. So he said, he got them passage in the hold of the ships, and the four of them came over to their, well, Dad's older brother here and his aunt. So that's...
Did you learn anything about his growing up and young life in Ireland with his family before he was a young man and part of the resistance?
Yes. They lived on a farm. Let's see. It was about 60 acres, and it was passed down from generation to generation, and it was in a little community called Castleogery. Their little church was, they called it a chapel, but it's as big as some of our churches, was at Ardahi. Yeah, let's see, Ardahi. And their main church that he called the church was Frost's. And we visited there. That's where the graveyard around the church is. And both of those churches are still very well kept and very well maintained. They were definitely profoundly Catholic. When he was young, I think he was probably the seventh son. And his mother and dad, from what an old neighbor told us, they must have had about 15 kids altogether, but a lot of them died at birth. And so he was, of the living, he was, there was nine that they saved. Somehow they called him the seventh son, so some of the dead sons must have, I mean, the babies that died must have been boys. But he was supposed to have had special innate talents for curing the sick or something. That was an Irish thought. His old cousin told us that he was supposed to have that. So he used to get called on in that community when he was a young man to go when somebody was dying or not feeling well. His mother, I kind of think he might have been one of his mother's favorites, because he said he used to sit in the house, and those old houses had, their fireplaces were just jutted out from the rock wall, and they had the beam across, the bar across, and then the crane for the pots to cook their food. And he said, I used to sit there and move the pot to the hottest spot for my mother. So,
what was his full name, Fran?
Francis Gallagher. Okay. I think they ran out of middle names.
So you're obviously named after your father.
Yeah, I was supposed to have been a boy, according to their calculations. But anyhow, as he grew up, I know he worked on the farm. They had the same thing we have in western Montana, horses and sheep and cows and pigs and chickens and geese and so on. He said when he was a child that the English still had enough control so they could come into your farm, leave the gates open, and hunt, fish, do whatever they wanted, and have no care about your animals or your farming process. And that really seemed to bug him. Let's see, what else can I tell you about him? He worked when he was a young man. He was working in town with his older brother in this little town of Mount Charles. He called it a shoe store, but I know he worked with tailoring at one time, I mean, selling menswear jackets from what he told us. And he used to go through the ritual of how you sell to somebody. But after I had met my Uncle Ed in New York and my Uncle Huey in Ireland, I think it was a front for the Sinn Féin movement. Because he had an older brother that worked for, that was a secretary and a journalist for Seamus McManus, who was one of the leaders in the Sinn Féin movement. And he hesitated to let us know very much at all about his actions with the resistance movement. He would kind of stop. And I didn't know until later when a nun at St. Luke's told me that, because he used to say, well, I'd die if I went to Ireland, back to Ireland. And I'd say, well, why would you die? And she said, well, he might have, because the English didn't give him amnesty till 1947. So I guess he knew what he was talking about.
Did he relax after that, your father?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't notice it because none of it meant
anything
at that, at that time.
Sure. Okay, well, now the boys are in New York.
The pardon?
The boys are in New York. The ship has landed. They've immigrated into New York. Tell us a little bit about his life after he got to the United States.
Okay, he apparently, his older brother was his sponsor here. And he went to work at a livery stable, and that was in the time when no Irish need apply. So he got the job in the livery stable because he was a horseshoer and a blacksmith, and that was when New York still had horses and carriages up and down the streets. And I think they might have thought that they were demeaning him because he worked with all colored people. And he thought they were the most fun. I said they wasted their time if they thought they were discriminating against him. Because he didn't notice any difference. You know, he just thought everybody was great. He did that for a while. Then he worked on a streetcar conductor later. And I think he was in Buffalo part of the time and in New York City. And then he came west, as most of his family and county people did, and went to Butte. And I think Butte was more well known in Ireland than any of the other rest
than
of the
America.
With Butte, America.
Yeah.
And he worked as a hard rock miner there. And he worked several years. Well, also in the middle of that was World War I, and he was drafted into the American Army. And one of the proudest things he ever did, he thought the American Army was just wonderful, and he loved the freedom he had here.
Do you know what division he was in?
Yeah, 137th Spruce, I think it was called. Okay. When he got out, he heard of land being opened up in the Flathead Valley, and that was an open reservation because they moved Indians from the Bitterroot up there, and each Indian family could choose 80 acres for their own. And then there was a lot of land left, so they opened it for white homesteaders. And so Dad and his brother and some of them went over there and homesteaded. He bought out a year's rights from one man. And he stayed there and for some time. He said he thought he would have had miner's consumption if he had not gotten out in the fresh air. And he said he, you know, had his cows and horses and stayed outside a lot on the farm.
So that was after the First World War?
Yes.
So we're into the 1920s now.
Yeah, okay. And then in order to support a farm, you have to have money. So he went back to Butte to the mines and worked again for several years. He must have been there, I don't know how many years, but that's where he met my mother, and they were married on St. Patrick's Day in 1924.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your mother now. This is a good place as she enters the picture.
Oh. She was a young woman that was raised in, well, her family, her father was from England, and he worked in the mines in a little, it's a, now a ghost town, Rochester, Montana. It's down between Twin Bridges and Dillon, up in the hills. And she lived there with her family. There were seven children, and she was the oldest.
Was she an immigrant, or was she born in
America? No, she was born in America. Her grandfather, I think, was 3 years old when he came from Germany. And her father, well, let's see, her mother was full-blooded German, because the grandmother was raised in Indiana, I think. Her mother, yeah, was full-blooded German, and she married a man from England, Robert Haxby. So mom was half English, half German.
And she was born where?
She was born in Rochester, Montana, in 1904.
Okay.
Then they moved out, her dad moved them out to a homestead out on the Big Hole River, and then he'd go away to mine because the mines had quit in Rochester. So he did a lot of absentee family living. And I think he was in Colorado, Arizona, Canada, and so on. She stayed there on the homestead, and that's where mom learned to really work, because she was the oldest. She had to take care of the cows and a lot, help a lot in the house. So she was pretty busy. Also a very bright person, and always inquisitive, and she used to tell us stories about her homesteading life.
Adventures.
And how she had to clean the stove, you know, and clean the ashes out when she was a little girl, and up in the mountain and the hills taking care of the cattle and seeing rattlesnakes that scared her. And then she moved to Butte to work, and she had worked at the orphan's home in Twin Bridges for a while before that.
What did she do in Butte?
I think she was a salesperson for some meat company there. And she met Dad at a dance.
And Tell us about their romance.
I don't know much about it, really. All I know is she and her girlfriend went to this dance, and my dad was the fiddler at the dance. And the lady, Julia, said to her, "Well, did you see anybody at that dance you liked better than yourself?" And she said, "Well, I guess maybe that little Irish curly-haired fiddler, he looked pretty good." So she met him, and that was it.
And they married on St. Patrick's Day.
They married on St. Patrick's Day.
In Butte.
And they lived there, about 3 years, because they had two children there. And then moved out to the Flathead. And by that time, Dad had sold his farm, his little 40-acre homestead, to his cousin. So he rented a place from another Irishman, Pat Casey. And we lived there till I was six, I guess, when he finally was able to buy his own farm. So that was that.
Okay. How about, do you have any background or stories or anything about the Gallagher name? Did your dad ever talk about that?
I do, but I can't tell you the whole thing. It's in here. They were descendants way back when of Nile of the Nine Hostages, which is almost mythology. Okay. They were a prominent name, and still are, in Donegal County. It used to be called Tyrconnell. And his dad's mother was a Sweeney, Mac Sweeney. The O'Donnells figured into their family. And as a clan, I guess you'd call it that over there, it was the O'Donnells, the Sweeneys, and the Gallaghers. And Dad used to say, well, I think Gallagher is I don't know exactly how to say it, it's friend of the people, I think. Something like that. But Dad used to say it meant burnt stick, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, that was their weapon, you know, way back in the beginning when they were invaded in that country." I guess that's what I know about that, I know Dad had a lot of relatives, and the house he lived in was 300 years old when he lived in it. And we took pictures of it when we were back there. Actually, I've got some here, one here if you want to see it.
Sure, show us.
This old stone, almost no mortar in it. It's pretty faded now. I've got... And the thatch is off of it, of course.
Wow, 300 years.
But it's probably about 400 years now.
It was still that. And he grew up there?
Pardon?
And he grew up there?
He grew up there, yeah. Wow. And they were, I'll go back to something about when he was a child. He said, we had running water. I said, how could that be? He said, well, there was a spring up, he called it on the hill beyond, if you go up from the back of the house, up the little slope of a hill. There was a spring, and his dad piped it into the house. So they had slate floors in that that rock house. The interesting thing I found was how low the doorways were. And I don't know if that was to keep the cold out or if they were that small a people. But I almost had to bend down to get in.
I think it was more an architectural detail for energy conservation than it was for the height of the people.
Because I noticed, and I hadn't thought of this till one of my girls said it when I was telling them after we got back. Vicky said, oh, that's why Grandpa always, when he went to go through the door, he'd bend his head down like that.
Even if he's in a 7-foot door?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And he and his mother both believed in the wee folk. His younger
Tell
brother.
Tell us about those traditions and thoughts. What you learned along.
Well, he said, a lot of people didn't believe in it, but he said, my mother and I, he said, we could go out in the evening, some evenings in the summer, and see the wee folk dancing out there up on the hill. And we said, well, what were they? He said, well, they were happy and singing, and they believed them to be the unbaptized souls of babies. And that was his version of it.
As being recognized as a healer in his family group, did that come from his birthplace of being a seventh son, or was it more of a talent that he exhibited?
It's supposed to be because he was a seventh son. Some custom they had over there is all.
Okay. When it came to naming and naming ceremonies or baptisms, did your family have any traditions in that regard?
Well, the only tradition I could see is it was almost written in blood. You named the first girl after her mother and one of his relatives. And the next, when my oldest brother was born, he had to be named after Dad's grandfather or father. Consequently, it's Seamus Vicky Gallagher, which you can't get any more Irish than that. Means James Michael.
Yeah.
The third one was named after his mother, and that was his mother was Elizabeth, so she was Elizabeth Ann. And then I was supposed to have been a boy, the fourth one, and I was supposed to have his name. Well, I guess that was a dilemma when they found out I was a girl, and the doctor said, just change that I to E and call her Frances. And then from there on, John was after a brother. Tish was Patricia. Well, he had a brother, Patty. Colleen was just what they called young girls in Ireland. It was Colleen. Colleen. So that's where her name came from. And I don't know where Rita got her name for sure. I don't know whose idea that was. Ed was named after Dad's brother. Mom finally got tired of it. And she said, well, I'm going to name some after my side of the family. So the next sister was Ethel, and that was my grandma's name, Mom's mom. Jeannie Genevieve, we called her Jeannie. I don't know where her name came from. George was after Mom's brother, and Danny, she just gave up when she got to that. They couldn't come up with a name, and so they finally settled on Daniel O'Neill. Mom said, if I got to have an Irish name, I got to make it good. So.
Did you and Harry continue that tradition when you named your children?
No, did not.
Okay. Great. Let's see here what else we can talk about. Did your dad ever talk about the journey over in the hold of the ship? Did he have any stories about coming across the Atlantic
not,
that he shared with you?
Not much. No, they were in the hold. I knew that. And I don't remember of any stories. I think it took him 10 days to come over.
And he never went back to Ireland again? He never returned?
Never got back. He said, I promised my mother I'd be back.
Let's stop. Get the phone out. I don't want it in your recording. Sorry, I should have turned it off.
I don't know, is that the kind of stuff you want?
Well, this is fantastic.
It's fabulous, Grant. Okay, turn this puppy off, I'm sorry.
Do you want some more to drink?
Oh yeah, maybe a little more tea.
And the puppy's on too.
Yeah, absolutely. So interesting about the seventh son business. Now, was he, because I've heard.
Go ahead and take it all, I'll make some more.
A handful of
you know what?
These things, but I'd never heard the seventh son thing before.
Actually, he had a gift, and I should mention this, and I don't know how or why, he never would let us know why, but he could be down in the field irrigating. Mm-hmm. And come up and say, well, you'll find out today that Ann so-and-so died. A neighbor, and I say, oh, Dad, you've been down in the field. How do you know that? And he said, no, I'm telling you, you'll find out. Sure enough, it would happen. Hmm. And he did it with another neighbor. He said, Grandma Wheeler died this afternoon. And we said, oh, son's getting to you, Dad. You're down in the field too long. He said, no, I'm telling you. And pretty soon, here comes one of her grandsons and said, yeah, she died.
So he had a gift.
He had a gift, but it wasn't in healing. His old cousin used to tell us, that's maybe something I want to record. His dad owned a racehorse, and Dad used to jockey for him when he was a teenager. And he said, my dad got greedy. And he ran the horse in two races in one day and winded the horse. So he was no good for a racehorse anymore. And he wanted Dad to cure him. See, they believed in it that much, I guess.
Wow.
Didn't work. So I think that story kind of fizzled out right there.
All right, are we rolling?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Do you speak any languages? Did you ever learn any Gaelic, Fran, that was spoken at home?
Dad never spoke it. I think that, you know, at school, the English schools were controlled in Ireland by the English, and they got beat if they spoke Gaelic at school. Mm-hmm. So they could only speak it at home.
Right.
Also, he was left-handed. He whacked if he used his left hand, so he had to learn to be right-handed. But he did teach us a prayer. I can do the sign of the cross in Gaelic. And I think at one time I knew the Hail Mary. I don't know. Learned a few swear words. A few classic little remarks. Oh, I guess it came a statue was one. It's how are you? And I could tell you some of the other ones, but I don't think you want them.
That's all right. I would like you to tell us the story that you shared with me about, I believe it was when you introduced Harry to your dad.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Harry was courting you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, well, Dad was a character. People used to come and like to listen to him. And he was funny, but even his way he put things together was funny. Yeah, well, Harry came over a couple of days after Christmas, this when he first met Dad. And so when he came, he's in his overcoat and his gloves and scarf. So he came in and I said, Dad, I want you to meet Harry Keith. And Dad said, Keith, you're Scotch. And here's Harry just still trying to get his gloves off. And Harry said, yeah, he said, Scotch-Irish. My mother's name was McCrary. And he said, oh, God, man, come in and have a drink. And I was embarrassed a little. I said, Dad, he doesn't need a drink yet. It was like 10 o'clock in the morning. He stopped. He said, Francie, go in and get the good bottle. And that was Irish whiskey, which one of us had given him. So he hid it in the, he kept it in the bedroom closet. And so I went to do that. I said, but Dad, he doesn't need a drink. And he said, he stomped his foot and looked around. He said, Mother of God, doesn't he drink?
He wasn't going to be much of a man if he didn't have a drink. Away.
So he had to take it whether he choked him or not. But Dad just reached up in the cupboard and got whatever size glass he got his hand on, filled it about half full. And he said, no, man. He said, throw that in ye. He said, I need the glass back.
I think that's such a great story. What other shenanigans did your dad pull on Harry?
Oh, not much on Harry. He really liked him. He would sit out under the tree in his big old blue chair and just keep Harry laughing all the time. And the more Harry laughed, the more stories he told.
And what other notorious stories can you think of about your dad that you remember?
I don't know. I can think of one that Harry laughed about the first time he met him. Dad was, like a lot of Irish, very outgoing. And he said, oh, Harry, he said, let us go to town and have a beer now. So they went to town, and which was 5 miles away, though. And they visited there for a while. And Harry said on the way, he was telling me after he left there, on the way home, Dad was telling him something he had been doing, I don't know, on the farm or what. And you know how most people would say, well, that sure loused up my averages. He'd say, well, that sure raised hell with my estimates. He had a lot of funny sayings. Mm-hmm. I mean, to us, they were funny.
Can you remember some of those and share?
Yeah, one time we were getting ready to go to a dance, and we had the old country schoolhouses where we had our dances. And whoever was getting ready, Dad would look after he got dressed up, and, ah, you look like Biddy Finesides, he'd say. Now, what's Biddy Finesides? He had Bridget that was slim, and that's what he was. Oh, it was a compliment, I guess. But, yeah, and he would do crazy things, you know, I mean, his sayings. When there'd be a bunch of grandkids around later, and there'd be little ones running around, he'd pat them on the head and say, ah, little one, it's a long way to Tipperary. But yeah, he was amusing to a lot of people. But I had a girlfriend that used to always come early when we were going to go to games or anything. And I had to do the dishes and get supper and do the dishes. And I'd get embarrassed because she'd be there. And I said, finally, I said, Betty Lou, I thought you were coming at 7:30. And she was there at 7. And she said, oh, I know I said that, but I like to listen to your dad. He's so funny. But that was an insult to me because, you know, to me he was like everybody else. I never noticed anything any different, you know, his accent until I left home.
Mm-hmm. So how long did your dad live?
He was 68 when he died. And he had a lot of stomach trouble. And he had copper dust on his lungs. It never went to active silicosis. But he was in and out of the hospitals. VA hospital or something, Walla Walla, and I forget where else. But they seemed to doctor him a lot for his stomach, too. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. He had a stroke right around Christmas time that year, and he died in April 6th.
Let's see,
1963. Okay. He lived long enough to know that we had a boy on St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, all right.
So that was good.
You and Harry did?
Yeah.
Oh, Harry.
Yeah.
Is that Daniel?
Yeah.
Daniel Patrick?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great, Fran. Did he live on his farm up until the time of his illnesses?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He lived on the farm always and raised hay, milk cows. We had pigs, chickens, geese, ducks, everything. Actually, and we always raised a huge garden. Some years he'd plant acre or maybe up to 4 acres of potatoes. And that wasn't much fun working out in those potato fields. But he would sell some of them then. He'd have. But we raised, every once in a while, he'd raise seed alfalfa and seed clover. And that was more specialized. It was, you had to cut it when it was, the dew was on it and shock it and then get the threshing machine there right at the right time. So he did those kinds of things. Actually, he worked out just about every fall when the farming was done, you know, with a big family. I mean, we had cream checks and that was about it. Oh, very poor, but then everybody was poor then. We didn't know they had a name for it.
Yeah, we think everyone was the same. Tell us a little bit more about Harry's musical abilities and his playing as Phil.
You mean Dad?
Yes, I'm sorry, your dad.
Well, he played at home. I mean, I know he played before he ever came to this country. And apparently they played, they had their own little hoolies, as they called them, in the homes. And I think I know he had one brother that played, Uncle Mike, that lived right close to us. And he and Dad used to play at the dances a lot.
Well, your dad played the fiddle. Do you know what Mike played? The
fiddle.
Okay.
And Mike was more of a showman than Dad. He was shorter and stockier. And he could play the fiddle behind his back. He could jig while he played the fiddle, but he usually took a few pints to do it, to get him going.
And did any of your siblings pick up the music tradition?
Well, I have brothers that play guitars, but Dad's fiddle was his pride and joy, and nobody touched it. Mm-hmm. So we didn't get to learn. But we were a pretty musical family anyhow. We danced and sang and did all that. And when people would, the Irish people, well, to start with, we had about, I think I counted 14 or 15 families that were immigrant Irish in that community. So it wasn't hard to get a group together at a dance. And if people came out from Butte, especially hunting season or in the summer, or from New York, where a lot of our relatives lived, you went up to the schoolhouse and had a dance. And they did their old half sets and some of that at the time. But if you put that in its perspective, everybody had a big family. So you had a lot of people to draw from. So we all danced and sang.
What other traditions came into your family through your father besides your music and in your mini Irish community that they associated with there in the valley?
What other?
Traditions, Irish traditions?
I don't know if you call it traditions. Dad liked goose for Christmas. That was an English and an Irish tradition.
How did you celebrate your Christmases as a family?
Big meal. We probably, Santa Claus brought one toy. We had oranges and apples and nuts and candy, which was a big treat to a big family during Depression. And we'd go to midnight mass if we had a car that ran. Otherwise, we'd go down to the little church that, incidentally, most of the Irish people in 1915, there was a lot of Irish people in that community already. Dad wasn't there yet, but his brother Mike was. They built the church along with the help of non-Catholic neighbors. Everybody got along, it seemed to me. And they got the money to build it by, the story I heard was, a lot of them had lived in Butte before, so Mr. Driscoll and his son went to Butte and they went to soliciting for money to all the pubs, all the bars, and they got enough money to buy the materials to build the church. And then later, Dad was a stonemason also, he built the steps and so on to the church. But it was 5 miles out of town, and we all went there, did all our sacraments there. And they finally built another church in Charlotte, And so our family got together. They were going to tear the building down, and all of our siblings and my mother got together and paid to hold on to the church to keep it from being torn down. And eventually my one brother that worked with historical old buildings got it put on the Montana Historical Registry and the National Historic Registry. We finally got it through the diocese, because the diocese really owns all those buildings. They turned it over to the DISD Women's Club that had been in service since the 30s. So they use it now, and they've had to keep it up, and it has to look authentic, like a church. Can't be used for a denominational church again, but it's used for community centers and receptions and so on. And they've done a really good job of taking care of it.
Did your father ever remark about how he spent Christmas in Ireland when he was growing up?
It sounded kind of the same. It was church, and then they had a meal, and I don't know, a goose was apparently what it was. He said they got one present, and he got a mouth organ one year for his gift, and he had all these older brothers, and he played on it, and then he finally decided he was going to hide it so his brothers wouldn't take it, and he went out and hid it beside the barn in the dirt. He said he went looking for it years later and he could never find it. So that's the story, all I know about that.
Oh, fun, interesting. How about any food traditions, Irish food traditions in your family?
Oh, actually, Mom had learned to make the soda bread and the caraway bread. And I remember during Lent we had a lot of salted cod and herring. And those were, cod and herring is what Dad had lived on in Ireland, because they were, of course, close to the water. A few times I remember this one neighbor, Mary Murphy, she'd gotten some seaweed, they call it dillisk, and I think they got another name for it here. She got some and she was all excited. She came running up the house. Guess what I got in the mail? Did you ever smell that stuff?
I don't think so. Just kelp out of the ocean.
It's kelp, yeah.
Okay.
But it's got an odor all its own.
Yeah.
But they came up to our house and we had a party, and we were little enough to have to go to bed, but they made those praline cakes, which is a potato cake, which is the same as boxty in Ireland. It's made with shredded potatoes, a little bit of mashed potatoes, eggs, some onion, salt and pepper, and you fry them like a pancake.
Sounds good.
That, and I don't know how they fixed that kelp, but no matter what you did to it, it still smelled.
Did your dad ever share with you his personal experience of suffering from any prejudice when he came into this country, when you mentioned earlier about Irish need not apply? I know you have a little plaque from that era that...
I have one of those?
Yes, we had it at the library display.
I don't think he ever felt any prejudice, because he didn't know prejudice. He'd lived under tyranny as a kid.
Right.
And to him, coming to this country was free, and everybody was just great. He had a lot of Indian friends. You know, there was a lot of immigrants at the time when he came to Montana. I know we had a guy from Luxembourg. We had Germans, Russians, Negro or two, and Italians. And he just relished all of their...
Yes, Butte was certainly in the melting pot.
Yes. Well, out on the farm, that's where we had a lot of them, too. But I think he was in that strike in Butte, the big one that kind of defined unionism for America. He was great on freedom, and he didn't want anybody messing with it.
So he appreciated the things that he gained in America when he immigrated.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, he loved this country.
Tell us about when he got his citizenship.
Well, I think when you have to be here 5 years, I understand, to get citizenship. So He did a lot of studying when he was when he had taken that homestead when he was younger, before he was married, and he had a lot of books. I mean, he knew as much about Thomas Jefferson and Roosevelt, I mean, not Roosevelt, Lincoln and Washington and our form of government as any kids that study it in high school. He did a lot of reading and a lot of studying when he was there by himself, he said, and then was naturalized, I think, in 1920.
Had he earned any college degrees in Ireland before he left at 21?
No, they went to school nearly year-round. They had a few weeks off in the winter and a few weeks off in the summer. But school ended at 13, unless you were wealthy enough to go to Belfast or to some bigger one of the cities. And you had to then, you know, sort of be farmed out to a couple that would take care of you. And so very few of them did that. But at age 13, he had an education that I think would rival some of our high school graduates, because he knew, he'd had Latin, he'd had Greek literature, he had all of the classical literature, he had a lot of poetry, he could still recite and tell you which book it was in. he had a lot of math. And apparently he was quite a bright person over there. But I know when my older sister was having trouble with geometry, trying to do her homework, and he'd get disgusted listening, and he said, "Hand me the book." And she would, and he'd look at it and just read it a while and say, "Well, the answer is such and such." And she'd say, "How did you get that, Dad?" He said, "Now, does it matter how I got it?" So I didn't help her much.
And then did he get his citizenship in Montana?
Butte, yeah, thanks so much.
All right, great. Well, it's been so nice, everything that you've shared with us today, Fran. I know you have a lot of memorabilia, and Patrick is going to take some pictures of some of those things for your archive. And you wanted to read us a poem.
Yes, before I do that, I'd have to, I said he worked out a lot.
Yes.
He worked on the Jocko Tunnel, he worked at Kerr Dam, he worked for the irrigation system and Nine Pipe. He worked for the CCCs as a teacher. Just untold, he did, and he built a lot of nice rock work fireplaces for wealthier people. We didn't have any on our farm, but he did it for other people. And
did he build any stone walls on his farm?
Nope. Yeah. He did stone work for people up at Placid and Sealy Lake, but and over at Hot Springs he built a cinder block hotel, I think it was. But we didn't have any. It's kind of like, you know, the shoemaker's kids don't have shoes. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any fireplaces or anything to show his work. He did build the gate piers at the Bison Range that are now, they've changed them in the last couple of years, though they've taken them down. So he did a lot of outside work that was, besides the mining, that was beneficial to but it was beneficial to building Montana. Mm-hmm. Actually, he had worked in the mines with Mike Mansfield. When Mansfield was young, and Dad was, of course, a little older, he said we helped him learn how to, you know, pick and do all the things in the mines. So, and then Mike would stop once in a while and see him when he was in western Montana.
By any chance, was your dad a Democrat?
Pretty much so. Yeah, I saw Dad, and I was talking about his freedom. He would get on his horse when we were little kids and go campaign, go solicit, you know, to give out information for candidates. He was a precinct man. He was a judge at the elections. So he took it all seriously. But he'd walk sometimes, you know, and campaign for people.
So he brought those political aspirations that were squelched for him in Ireland to America and exercised.
Yeah, he did indeed. Yeah, indeed.
Great. Yeah. Any other stories about your dad you'd like to share before we wrap up?
I can't think of any. It'll probably go on and on if I could think a while, but I think that's enough.
Okay.
Yeah, this poem that I had. No, where did it go? I had it right on top once.
It's okay. You find it. We have time.
Just click it off for a while.
I know you showed it to us, so I know it's there.
It's here. Well, so much for putting it right where I can find it.
That's all right. You'll find it. I think it might be in that. Yeah, right where you're looking. Down through there.
No. I'll find it.
Okay.
Did I leave it over there?
I thought you brought it over with your book. Show Patrick that picture of your dad with his fiddle.
And that's he won the couple.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
We've been doing displays in the library for Irish History Month in March. Mm-hmm. In town. And she still has his fiddle. So we always do.
One of my brothers have the fiddle. I don't have
it. Oh, that was a different one that we...
Yeah, that's an old fiddle.
Oh, okay.
But no, my brother got his fiddle. He did. That rosin was all over it.
Yep.
But he would sit down at night, I remember when we were little kids, you know, come in after he did his milking the cows and get out his fiddle and play. And I remember just sitting around the stove listening to him play. And he did learn some American tunes as he started playing. But he played a lot in Butte and Anaconda. And I think that was all probably Irish music.
Did anyone in the family ever get a chance to record him playing?
We got him recorded once, but it was up in the old schoolhouse, empty and no back. No, usually he had a guitar accompaniment for the kids. But, when he played at those contests, he did that. Yeah, here is the poem that I thought summed up the Irish people. It was written by Ed Cunningham. It's called Gift of the Irish. They came not as conquerors, but as believers in the promise of America. They came with hopeful hearts and willing hands to make a home far from the world they knew. They came with faith to light their way and humor to ease their journey. They came with pride when they were, excuse me, I'll start again. They came with pride in who they were and courage to overcome all hardships as they followed their cherished dreams of freedom. With these gifts, they built a new life in a new land. Sharing these gifts, they blessed and brightened this land that they came to love. The history of our nation has been made fuller and richer by this faithful family of Americans. These good and gifted people, the Irish, may St. Patrick's Day fill your heart with pride and joy and love for all it means to be Irish and American.
Thank you. That's great, Fran. I do have to ask you about one other bit of story that you have shared with me that I think is fascinating, too, about your dad and reflects his life experience. Tell us about the tricolor Irish flag.
Oh. And I think it was his Hibernian sash. Mm-hmm. But every year at St. Patrick's Day, he'd cut a little snippet off, pin it on our clothes, and we wore it to school. And it was green, white, and gold. And that's all I knew until I grew up. And that's why it was interesting the other night when you read that. It was 1848 when they changed. He never changed.
How did he feel about the Orangemen?
Pardon?
How did he feel about the Orangemen?
Not too good. I mean, he had classic profanity for him.
Indeed.
But he... I didn't know that what it was from, this ribbon, until after...
Right, you were growing up.
Yeah, after I was growing up.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. They had a lot of little ditties to tell where the English were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to do one, he'd have his hands, let's see how it, oh, I can't remember right now, but it's, he'd fix his hands like this somehow and say, put your finger in the crow's nest, the crow's not at home. It's over Ballyshannon picking a big white stone. And that was part of their way of telling where the English were.
Mm-hmm.
But you were supposed to stick your finger in here before he caught you.
Ah.
And it was a game.
Ah, that's great.
But, all I heard about the English, I mean about the Orangemen and the APA, American Protective Association, was not good words.
Were you ever aware, even as an adult later in life, that he and his brother Mike, when they were working in Butte, were part of the Hibernians or sent money home to support?
Dad sent money home.
Yeah.
I've got a few little, money order receipts,
mm-hmm.
that we found. I just made photocopies of them.
Was it for the resistance or just to help support his family?
Who knows?
Okay.
I think it was sent to the mother. Always it was the mother that got things over there. And mother was, nobody did a show, like at midnight at our dances. When you stop for lunch at midnight in those country dances. People used to come from town just to listen because all the Irish, they'd say, well, how about, get up, Pete, and sing us a song. Come on, Paddy, and say your poem. And you had jigs and dances and speeches. I remember one, this old guy used to say, the Emmett speech at the dock. And all those Irish people would clap and clap, and I thought, what was so great about that? but I found out after I grew up,
mm-hmm.
it was a fiery freedom speech.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of characters there, tap dancing, jigging, singing, all that.
All of your life growing up, did you know that you were Irish and you had Irish pride in your growing up years in Montana?
Not really. I think that, I know I talked to one of my cousins, Uncle Mike, one of his kids, and I think we felt you're safe in your group of Irish people. And we did fine with going to school and with mixing with other people, but I think there was a little bit of a fence that your dad didn't speak the way other people did, and he was funny and people loved him, and his word was as good as gold, so nobody minded dealing with him, and a hard worker, but I think we kind of felt a little bit of that, not so much that it stopped us, any of us. Actually, what it does for you is give you more grit. It gives you more solid grounding that I can go ahead. And so that's what I think we got out of it.
Great, that's wonderful. Really, thank you for
you're welcome.
Being part of the gathering, and you have such a wonderful story. And I always enjoy when you can even share with me personally some of your stories. So thank you.
Well, thank you.